listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Prashant Parameswaran, our Southeast Asia-focused editor. On this week's podcast, Prashant and I will break down some of the salient takeaways and themes of the recent summit between ASEAN leaders and U.S. President Barack Obama in Sunnylands, California, and then we'll spend some time talking about the recent deployment of surface-to-air missile systems by China to Woody Island and the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea. So before I turn it over to Prashant, who's been covering this extensively for us at The Diplomat, the ASEAN summit is historical in many ways. And I do want to talk a bit about the chronology. I mean, this isn't primarily my beat, but, you know, I've been kind of observing some interesting things in U.S.-ASEAN policy. So, you know, in November 2015, you had the plan of action on implementing the U.S.-ASEAN strategic partnership. Following that, in December, Obama invited the ASEAN leaders to Sunnylands for the summit in February, and on New Year's Eve, on December 31st, the ASEAN community was launched. And, you know, you follow that up with January, when U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry travels to Laos, the current chair of ASEAN, to discuss a range of issues, including U.S.-ASEAN cooperation. And finally, in February, we have this historic summit, which is the first of its kind on U.S. soil between a president of the United States and the 10 leaders of ASEAN. So, Prashant, it's clear that ASEAN is higher than ever on the U.S. strategic radar in the Asia-Pacific. And obviously, ASEAN has been a big part of the rebalance or pivot to Asia strategy. But why don't you take us a bit more, you know, into the weeds on precisely, I guess, the significance first of this Sunnylands summit. What, in your view, is the primary significance of this historic summit?
Yeah, so I think precisely as you said, Ankit, I think it's useful to situate the holding of the summit, which is, you know, the first ever standalone meeting between the United States and the leaders of Southeast Asian countries happening in the United States within the context of the broader U.S. rebalance to the Asia-Pacific, which we saw under the Obama administration. I think for the administration, the chief symbol of this summit is that it symbolizes its commitment to Southeast Asia and ASEAN as an organization within U.S.-Asia policy. And I think that it is sort of the capstone of several initiatives that the administration has taken, which demonstrated that commitment. So the United States, you know, if you recall, going back a few years ago, ratified the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, became the first non-ASEAN country to appoint a resident ambassador to ASEAN, joined the East Asia Summit, which was a controversial decision that had some debate within the administration as well. So this is very much the capstone of a series of initiatives that the Obama administration has taken. I think in addition to the symbolism, which is pretty significant, I think substantively, as you pointed out, it was an opportunity for the administration to build upon the momentum of, you know, the elevation of U.S.-ASEAN relations to the level of a strategic partnership, which, as you noted, happened last November. And, you know, in the last November, they sort of came up with this plan of action to implement the strategic partnership, which was a 14-page document, very much in the weeds. But this summit was an opportunity for leaders to meet in a more candid fashion, to talk more informally about some of the issues regionally, globally, and bilaterally among them.
Yeah, so, Prashant, you know, staying on the topic of the significance, I also wanted to ask you, you know, I mean, would you describe this as kind of an epical event in U.S.-ASEAN relations? I mean, are we entering a new era, would you say, or is this simply, you know, building on progress, you know, building on the bricks that have been laid down in the past? Or, you know, how do you see this precisely in, like, the long-term strategic outlook for U.S.-ASEAN ties?
Yeah, I think that's precisely the question that the administration wanted to raise. I think part of it was the administration saying we're going to have the summit to sort of indicate the priority that we're giving to ASEAN and Southeast Asia. But, you know, recall this is happening during an election year. So the administration is also publicly, as I said this, it wants to send a message to the next administration that engaging Southeast Asia as a subregion and ASEAN as an institution is really important, and it should. The next administration should also continue this level of engagement. So very much trying to institutionalize a lot of these things. So the U.S.-ASEAN strategic partnership that was signed in November, a big part of that initiative was the administration's, you know, public commitment to say we want to institutionalize our relationship with ASEAN at the highest level possible, which is a strategic partnership. And this summit is sort of the indication that this is the level of engagement that should proceed between the United States and ASEAN, which is the highest potential engagement with at the leaders level.
Great. So let's talk a bit about outcomes. So, the way I see it, there's always two outcomes to a lot of these summits. You have kind of the public-facing statement, which a lot of people focus on simply because, it's intended for public consumption. In this case, we had a 17-paragraph statement, which is considerably less specific than the 14-page statement that we had in November on the broader strategic partnership. But then, we also have the general outcomes of, behind the door, candid conversation between leaders, which builds confidence, helps agenda setting for an organization like ASEAN. Agenda setting is very important. So, can you take us a bit into the weeds on, I guess, accomplishments on both sides of that?
Yeah, sure. So, in terms of the public-facing document, the outcome document was the Sunny Lens Declaration, which was, as you pointed out, the 17-page, 17-paragraph, sorry, statement of commonly shared principles between the United States and ASEAN. So these include freedom of navigation and economic openness, but also specific priority issues like, countering the Islamic State, tackling climate change, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the main objective here in the administration's mind was to sort of flesh out what they mean by a shared commitment between the U.S. and ASEAN to what they call the rules-based order in the Asia Pacific. So whether it's, rules in the security domain when it comes to freedom of navigation, or in terms of economics when it comes to openness and trade and investment, this is the main priority for the United States and ASEAN going forward. I think the key things to keep in mind in the beyond the statement itself, I would group into two categories. The first would be the economic component, second would be the security component. I think the most important component would be the economic dimension. I think that's where you saw the administration very much wanted to boost its regional economic approach, because apart from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which only groups four Southeast Asian countries, it has struggled to come up with a region-wide approach to engage Southeast Asia economically. So I think one notable achievement was the coming up of or the unveiling of US-ASEAN Connect, which is a new US government initiative, which uses a network of, three hubs across Southeast Asia in three capitals, Singapore, Jakarta, and Bangkok, to kind of coordinate US economic engagement. I think that's sort of the main economic piece. I think the security side, that's tougher, because a lot of the security cooperation that's ongoing is very sensitive. It's also bilateral, right? So whether it's intelligence sharing on Islamic State or, maritime domain awareness in the South China Sea, a lot of these things are private. But Obama did announce, for example, on the Islamic State, he said that he had offered assistance to Southeast Asian countries to help leverage Interpol data to prevent the flow of foreign terrorist fighters, which is a pretty significant development. And I think we'll get into the South China Sea issue soon, which is the other critical component.
Right, and actually, let's move the conversation there now. So, just so listeners know, just hours before we started recording this podcast, Prashant published quite a long opinion piece on why critics of this Sunny Lens Declaration are a little bit misguided when they say that this 17-paragraph declaration wasn't quite a success when it came to the South China Sea, simply because, a lot of the common criticisms are the language was vague, it didn't specifically call out China. But, Prashant, I thought, made a very good point in that case, in that piece that I want to bring up now to frame our conversation around the South China Sea, is that we need to think about ASEAN, as it is, not ASEAN as it should be. And Prashant, I'll let you explain that, since I thought you did it very well in your piece. So why don't you kind of rehash what you meant there?
Yeah, thanks, Ankit. I think the critical point that I wanted to emphasize in the piece was that, ASEAN is a very diverse group of countries. There are only four claimants in the South China Sea within ASEAN. There are several, so-called interested parties like Indonesia and Singapore and Thailand that think they have a stake in the South China Sea and want to be forward-leaning, even though they don't have claims. But there are also other countries like Cambodia, for example, that do not have a stake in the South China Sea and are very close economic partners with China. And in the past, they've proven very unwilling to move on the South China Sea issue. And since ASEAN operates on the basis of consensus, the lowest common denominator approach is always not going to be enough for people who want a very forward-leaning response when the eventual statement comes out. So the point that I was making in the piece, one of the key points was that we shouldn't expect ASEAN to come up with very significant, forward-leaning statements, because we're bound to be disappointed. I think what we should look for is that ASEAN, given what, for example, China is doing in the South China Sea, regardless of the divisions that exist between the various countries, they're still able to agree on a common set of principles like freedom of navigation, the peaceful resolution of disputes, observance of international law, that these are the principles that should undergird how these disputes are resolved, even though there are divisions among the bloc.
And another principle that I'd add that is significant after Sunnylands is non-militarization, right? I believe that was the first time that we've seen that in a U.S. ASEAN statement.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, there are two significant developments when it comes to the South China Sea in terms of the Sunnylands Summit. The first was, as you correctly pointed out, the use of the term non-militarization. That was not present in similar U.S.-ASEAN statements when they were issued in November. I think the second thing that's notable is a mention in one of the other paragraphs on maritime security that says, full respect for legal and diplomatic processes without resorting to the threat or use of force, which, it's a clear indication and reference to the arbitral court's decision that's expected in May on the South China Sea between, China and the Philippines. So that's another key development in the South China Sea issue.
Right. So Prashant, let's move the conversation past Sunnylands now to China's response a day after. I guess this isn't really a response. It was an event that took place in the South China Sea that many observers took as a well-timed response after the Sunnylands declaration. So the day after the summit ended, we read reports that China had moved HQ-9 surface-to-air missile systems to Woody Island in the Paracels. And let me talk about Woody Island a bit, because actually it's a very interesting feature in the South China Sea. It's an island. Hundreds of people live on this island, hundreds of Chinese citizens. It's the capital of China's Sanxia Prefecture, which is how China administers the Paracels, which it both claims and currently controls. Vietnam also claims the Paracels, and China has, essentially non-legal straight baselines drawn around these islands. So Woody Island, when we're talking about this, it's very different, and I really want to emphasize that it's very different from, the artificial islands in the South China Sea that we've also discussed, where China is building, military facilities, placing radars, and undertaking all sorts of other activity. So the day after this summit ends, China moves surface-to-air missile systems, clearly an indication that it's not really intending to follow any requests by the United States or ASEAN to prevent, non-militarization, because as far as China's concerned, this is its rightful territory. Now, the HQ, let me just talk a bit about the HQ-9 as a system. It's actually pretty interesting, has an interesting history. It's sort of a potpourri of Russian and U.S. technology. It incorporates and resembles actually Russia's advanced S-300 SAM systems, but also incorporates technology from the United States-owned Patriot missile systems, which China allegedly acquired some of the technology behind the Patriot from Israel, actually, since the United States gives Israel Patriots and China managed to acquire a unit. So the HQ-9 is a potent system. It has a range of around 125 miles, if my memory serves me correctly, and generally it shows that China is, ramping up its military presence in the South China Sea and Woody Island. So Prashant, what is, how do you read this provocative move the day after Sunnylands ends?
Yeah, I think it's, as you pointed out, I mean, it's just the latest step that we've seen in terms of Chinese assertiveness in the South China Sea. I think the additional point to emphasize was that the United States and ASEAN over the past few months, since Xi Jinping made his trip to the United States and made essentially a pledge not to militarize the South China Sea, they have been basically trying to come up with a way to codify that statement and hold Xi Jinping to his word, and that was one of the reasons why non-militarization was included in the statement. And the United States and other Southeast Asian countries have begun to refer to this quite frequently in their public remarks. So the fact that China is now doing this is, by some interpretations, most interpretations, I would argue, a violation of that non-militarization pledge. I think the complicating factor, though, is the fact that, as you correctly pointed out, Woody Island is very different from some of the other features that we've been talking about. It's been militarized for some time. It's been militarized for decades, actually. It already houses, hangars and military aircraft. And so the challenge really that in terms of interpreting Chinese behavior is the Chinese have already said, A, this is something which is not a new development, and B, it is a response to the U.S. Freedom of Navigation operations in the parasols that we saw not too long ago. So this is a familiar debate that we have between the United States and China in terms of, you know, whose fault it is that the South China Sea is being militarized. And I think that militarily the implications are pretty severe, and we can talk about it more in detail, but you know, at first glance, I mean, if the United States is planning on doing more, you know, maritime patrols in waters surrounding the paracels, and China has the system deployed, technically, you know, China could threaten the security and safety of U.S. Planes and U.S. ships that are operating there, which is a pretty significant development.
Absolutely. I think, unfortunately, Prashant, we'll have to end this conversation here, but of course there's a lot more detail to be discussed here. Thanks, as always, for your granular insights, particularly on the ASEAN stuff. It's very good to have you on.
Thanks.
And if you like this podcast, as always, remember to subscribe and leave us a review on iTunes with your thoughts on what you'd like to see on upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening.